Kova, Levinson, Nakayama, and Duffy. May it please the court, I represent the defendant appellant, the Rawlings Company. With me here today is my associate, Devin Peterson, and sitting on this side of the bench are representatives of the Rawlings Company, their counsel, so they were told they could sit on this side of the bench. Plus, they had to because they asked me what they should wear, aloha shirts, because everyone wears aloha shirts, and I said they had to wear a suit and tie. So we have to let them sit there.
Subject to debate.
We're here today because plaintiffs contend that a subrogation organization such as my client, Rawlings Company, is a debt collector who is required to register under Hawaii's Fair Debt Collection Act, Chapter 443B. One of the main points that I think we have to understand today as a premise for any ruling on this appeal is that no subrogation organization, such as the Rawlings Company or HRI Chover, as was cited in the Hamilton case cited by the appellees, has ever been held liable as a debt collector under any state or the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And this is because the claim that is being pursued, or HMSA's rights, are subrogation rights, equitable subrogation rights under the law against third-party tortfeasors. Now, subrogation, as this court is aware, is a transfer of a cause of action from one person to another. That's the basic Black's Law Dictionary definition, and that is the definition adopted by this court in Peters v. Witherwax, 69 Hawaii 21. In Peters, this court recognized that a subrogated party, in that case the state of Hawaii, owned the tort claim that was transferred. And in that case, it was very similar. The state had paid out welfare medical benefits to the claimant, and the claimant settled with the third-party tortfeasor, and the claimant then made the argument that my settlement was general damages only, so you state cannot reimburse the amounts you paid out under welfare for my medical expenses. And this court held, no, the state paid out your medical expenses, so HMSA paid the insured's medical expenses, and then you, the insured, you sued a third party to seek reimbursement of your claims, which included a bundle of claims, right? Your personal injury, whatever, your physical damages, your medical expenses. And in Peters v. Witherwax, this court said, the state had already paid your medical expenses. The state is accordingly, by operation of law, equitable, subrogated to your rights against the third-party tortfeasor. So it was a transfer of the injured party's claim to the state of Hawaii by operation of law. And that's what happened in this case. Rawlings is a subrogation recovery organization. HMSA paid the injured party's claims. They then pursued tort claims. They paid the medical expenses, I'm sorry. The plaintiffs then pursued tort claims against the third-party tortfeasors who were responsible for their injuries. HMSA, only when it learned that they were pursuing those claims, put the plaintiffs on notice that it was seeking, HMSA was asserting its right to seek reimbursement from the third-party tortfeasors for the medical expenses portion of their claim, as was their right. And I think this is also,
so,
I'm sorry.
Ms. Andrews, it's Rawlings' function, contractual function with HMSA, to collect for HMSA monies contractually due to HMSA from third persons.
From third-party tortfeasors, but it's not contractually per se. HMSA's plan document.
I mean contractual in the sense that, as I understand it, I'm an HMSA insured, and I think there are contractual provisions running between HMSA and me with respect to my obligation to allow HMSA to recoup certain monies that it's paid out on my behalf under certain conditions. And Rawlings pursues those claims.
Well, the contract is with HMSA and the employer entities, and that contract does say that HMSA has the right to seek reimbursement of amounts it pays out when third-party tort claims are involved.
And that's what Rawlings is pursuing.
Rawlings is pursuing its third-party, the claims against the third-party tortfeasors, which it has a right to by the plan language and also equitable subrogation under Hawaii law. There's just...
If Rawlings weren't doing it, HMSA would be doing it.
Well, HMSA would be asserting its right to recoup the funds it paid only, but remember, they only do this after the injured, I'll just call them the injured party or the insured, provides notice that they're going to sue a third-party tortfeasor and get back the monies that HMSA paid. So by operation of Hawaii law, the Peters case, any claim the plaintiffs have against the third-party tortfeasor for the portion of the medical expenses, that cause of action is by operation of law transferred to HMSA. And in this case, it's similar to HRS section 663-10, where the Hawaii legislature recognized rights of the collateral source rule and the protection of rights of subrogation. And it provides in there that if a medical provider or a health plan or pays out these medical benefits and a claim is made for those benefits by the injured party against a third-party tortfeasor, you step into the shoes, HMSA stepped into the shoes and owned that claim, and were entitled to seek reimbursement of those amounts from the third-party tortfeasor. Because that's the only fair thing to do. HMSA paid their medical expenses. Now, HMSA didn't go against them, or would not have gone against them. You know, HMSA, we all...
I'm not suggesting any unfairness.
Yeah. Okay.
My inquiry really is whether Rawlings is effectively a surrogate of HMSA.
Well, they're a subrogation recovery organization, yes, and they're representing HMSA.
What about the Hamilton case that the appellees indicate would fit this situation or would apply to this situation? How do you distinguish that?
Hamilton is the only case that holds that a subrogation claim is a debt. Okay, so Hamilton 1, that's a 2002 opinion by one panel of the Fifth Circuit Court that they cite to you, held that a subrogation claim was a debt. Okay, Hamilton then went back to the trial court, and the case was, further action was taken, and then Hamilton went up on appeal again to the Fifth Circuit, and that was a 2004 decision, and that's an unpublished decision I cited in my briefs. In Hamilton 2, another panel, it's unpublished, but it is, in my view, law of the case because it affects the ultimate outcome the 2002 opinion. It's still ruling on the same case. In Hamilton 2, I'll call it, 2004, the Fifth Circuit Court held that Trover, HRI Trover, which is one of the main competitors of the Rawlings Company, was not a debt collector because the debt was not due and owing, or the debt was not in default. The federal statute provides that you can't sue on a debt that's not in default.
Hamilton 2 may have been law of the case binding the parties. Is it precedential?
I think as to that case, it found that the debt wasn't due and owing. So like in Hawaii law, the language is it has to be due and owing, because just like in this case, a subrogation.
You said it was unpublished.
Yes, but you see.
Is it precedential in this jurisdiction?
Well, I feel it is, because it affects the 2002 decision.
Because it's law of the case?
Because it, well, maybe it's not law of the case, but you have another panel.
It is, with respect to the parties to the matter.
Well, you have another panel doing a ruling that's directly contradictory and makes no sense of the 2002 ruling. Because if the debt's not due and owing,
why isn't it published?
I think that the 2000 in court made a mistake, and the other panel was trying to clean it up. Because if the debt's not due and owing and you're not a debt collector, then it can't be a debt either.
Well, there are a lot of reasons why things aren't published, but so we don't know. But
correct.
Whether it's published or not, we can still look at it as being persuasive or non-persuasive. But if your contention is correct, then is Rawlings totally excluded from any regulation under the statute?
Well, you know, this case is compounded by the problem that...
I mean, they are collecting
yeah,
money.
Yeah.
They are acting on citizens or residents of the state. And under your approach, they're totally unregulated. They're not subject to any kind of regulation, even though they go out and collect money.
Well, yes, but they're collecting it from third-party tortfeasors.
Well,
but, no,
well,
I understand,
I mean,
Justice. Yeah.
They're collecting money from residents of the state.
Chapter 480-2 is a statutory remedy that exists over and above all the existing cause of remedies in the state. So they could be sued for conversion, for fraud, for breach of contract, for other torts. They can
what
be
if they engage in conduct that would otherwise fall under 443, except for the fact that under your interpretation of the statute, they're not a debt collector.
If they engage in conduct different from what they did in this case, that is, this court deems, but different from this case, that this court deems is a violation of 443, then this court could find them responsible. If they, for example, went out and, you know, started...
Under your interpretation of debt, they could never be a debt collector.
Oh, no, no. Not what they're doing now, no. No, and no other case has ever held that they could be. So even the unpublished decision in Hamilton, 2004, said H.R. Trover is not a debt collector because the money wasn't due and owing. Just like in this case, this is an unliquidated claim. HMSA pays the money. HMSA has no rights to recoup the money. Claimants, you know, go out and make claims against third parties. That's when the claim, the right, will transfer out of any funds that are recouped from that third party. Now, in this case, HMSA,
Rawlings, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Would if a private person cannot apply this act or bring it under 480, would some government agents, would the, I don't know who's in charge of administering this statute, but, or the Attorney General, would they be able to bring actions under 443 against Rawlings for a situation like this one?
Yes, Your Honor. The Attorney General could enforce violations against Rawlings if the Attorney General so deemed that they were violating the law. Also, in this case, I want to just point out, these plaintiffs do not have standing in any event. Even if you want to find that pursuing a subrogation claim against a third party, because in this case, all that happened was that Rawlings worked with plaintiff's counsel. Rawlings, you know, HMSA could have filed its own lawsuit, gone to small claims court for one of the cases, $4,000, you know, filed its lawsuit for reimbursement directly under the tortfeasor, or could have intervened, and Mr. Flores was in a bar fight at Gussie Lamore's. He filed a complaint for tort relief. Could have intervened there. But HMSA Rawlings worked with plaintiff's counsel to get its recovery from the third-party tortfeasor. And at all time, plaintiff's counsel acted as if the funds belonged to HMSA. This money went through plaintiff's lawyer's client trust account and was held in that trust account. And plaintiff's lawyer even told HMSA through Rawlings, you know, if you don't agree to take less and bear in mind all the fees, what attorney's fees, then I'm just going to hold this money until we have a court judgment or other settlement deciding your entitlement to the amount you paid in medical expenses. And that is because under 663-10, the legislature, under Peters v. Witherwax, equitable subrogation, that money belonged to HMSA. Now, in this case, going back, plaintiffs have no standing in any event. If this was just a pure, straight-on debt collector that, you know, is collecting for Bank of Hawaii $5,000, sends the letter, you know, you're in default, you owe this $5,000. These plaintiffs, this case would still have to be dismissed because they have no standing. First of all, they didn't purchase anything. They didn't pay any money toward the purchase of their health insurance. Their employers did, and they don't dispute that. They didn't purchase medical insurance. I mean, they didn't pay for their medical claims. In fact, you know, when this action started out, the complaint just talks about the purchase of insurance is the contract that HMSA paid, you know, $8,000 on behalf of one and settled and took back less than $8,000 and paid X on behalf of the other and took back less than the other. And that's the whole case. And when we moved, and also I sent them admissions saying, what are your damages? Because Hawaii case law was clear. You need actual damages for a violation of this type. They answered in their admissions, which are in the record and cited to, that the only injury they had was the per se violation of not registering as a debt collector. And that is not Hawaii law. Under I v. Frankhoff Agency, under just Judge Mawe's interpretation of Hawaii law.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
When you talk about purchase now, you're talking about 480.
Yes, 480, because they're claiming that we've, you know, violated that statute by not registering as a debt collector. And they say the violation of 480 is the per se failure of Rawlings not to register. So
what authority do the appellees have for arguing that they fit under 480, the consumer, the definition of consumer?
They rebut the fact that they have no purchase and no damages by citing to the Kelly case, which is an unpublished decision of the district court here, and Connecticut law. They string cite a whole bunch of Connecticut law. Now, the Kelly case, if you read it, it's unclear what was being done there. And that's why in Sambor, Judge Mawe said basically, it's not clear what Kelly was holding because the opinion appears incomplete, but that Hawaii law is clear. You need injury. And that, you know, a per se statutory violation of 443B is not going to be your injury, number one. And number two, the fact that it appeared that, you know, the plaintiffs, you know, sort of recruited lawyers to try to make a claim by filing a violation was not injury. So no matter what, even if you hold that a subrogation claim is a debt under 443B, which you shouldn't, you don't even need to get there, and you shouldn't get there because nobody holds that except Hamilton. And when you read the subsequent history, another panel in an unpublished decision, but nonetheless seems to disavow the holding in the 2002 case, because you can't not be a debt collector because the claim's not due and owing and it yet be a debt. If it's not due and owing, it's not a debt.
If I might interrupt you, Sanders,
yeah.
I have a couple questions. One is that it seems to me that the Hawaii law defines collection agency more broadly than the federal law regarding debt collectors. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but in what manner do you...
Well, just generally in that. I mean, we take care of regulating debt collectors under Chapter 480D, correct?
Right.
And yet we have Chapter 443B as well. And let me ask you this. How do you factor in the fact that HMSA has this interest-free loan between the plaintiffs and themselves. I mean, it seems to me that that would make, put this in the consumer context.
The document that's, you know, titled a loan agreement creates no additional rights in HMSA. It is just notice to the insured that we are aware of a third-party claim that you have for reimbursement of monies that that third party owes us, because HMSA has the right to that money. So it's just, it's inartfully titled, I would tell you that, but it's not a loan agreement creating new rights. You know, it's just notice to the third party, and they can sign it or not sign it, and a lot of times people don't sign it. And the plan documents say that, you know, whatever rights we have under Hawaii law is what we have. So it was just a notice to those
third
parties.
I can interrupt you once more, but it seems to me that the plaintiffs in this case did sign the loan agreements, correct?
So yes, they did.
So it seems that they could have been sued if they didn't either work out a compromise settlement with Rawlings or pay back the full amount. They could be sued for violating the loan agreement.
Well, but the loan agreement says that HMSA has rights against the third-party tortfeasor, and that they're just putting these parties on notice that it has rights, just like 663-10 says. You know, if you have a claim against a third party and somebody else is pursuing that suit, to protect yourself, you got to put them on notice that we have these rights against the third parties. So it didn't create any extra rights, and HMSA, you know, never had and, you know, never has sued anyone on those loan, you know, so-called loan agreements, because HMSA's claim is against the third party. It's an inartfully document. I'm sorry, I have to say, Justice Duffy, I mean, you know, the title of it is not the greatest, you know, as far as I'm concerned, but, you know, it doesn't change the fact that it doesn't create any rights, that HMSA's rights arose, you know, out of equitable subrogation and existed at the time they made the claim. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. If everyone's okay, I'd like to reserve.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tom Grandy for Plaintiffs Appellees. The Rawlings Company is asking the court to allow it to continue to collect money in Hawaii without a license. And the record shows that the Rawling Company, since 2000, has never registered or applied to register as a collection agency, has never registered as a business in Hawaii, and yet has collected on hundreds of accounts on behalf of HMSA. And if the court rules in their favor, it opens the door to collection agencies, whether located here or on the mainland, to avoid regulatory protections, business protections, and consumer protections that are contained in Chapter 443B. That statute is an amalgam of regulatory rules that are required to be followed, such as the requirement of a certificate of good standing, of business rules that protect the clients, such as the requirement to be bonded and the requirement to do periodic accountings, and consumer rules that protect consumers, such as no abusive collection practices. And yet at the heart, at the start of all of these protections is the requirement to register. That's the precondition for these protections to come into play. And without registration, none of the regulatory or business protection or consumer protection requirements apply to a company like Rawlings.
Why hasn't the Attorney General done anything then?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and the Attorney General, I can't answer for the Attorney General. The Attorney General might have authority to do something, as well as other businesses might have authority to do something. I think that in the context of a statute like 443B, where it's tied to 480, I think that the legislature is looking to a private-public partnership to enforce the law. There are many, many statutes that basically look for and allow public enforcement, but they also encourage private enforcement, because certainly the Attorney General has limited resources and is not able to address every single situation.
Mr. Grandy, there may be some problems with qualifying under 443, but under 480, how do you get around the definition of consumer, where there is apparently no purchase of goods or services? Or do you disagree that, in fact, there was a purchase of goods or services?
Well, I think there's two ways to address that, Your Honor. First of all, there was an obligation that the plaintiffs had to pay for their medical services. They signed an agreement with their health care providers saying they were responsible for paying for those amounts. So in that instance, I'd say that taken alone, it fits within 480. Secondly, there is the loan agreement, which imposed an obligation for repayment to HMSA. And I think taken alone, that fits within Chapter 480. I think third, the definition of consumer in 443B is really the same definition of consumer in 480. Debt is defined as monies due and owing arising out of a consumer transaction. And if you meet the definition of 443B, you certainly meet the definition of Chapter 480. And respectfully, Your Honor, to rule otherwise would mean that 443B20, which says that a violation is a per se violation of Chapter 480 for unfair competition and for unfair and deceptive acts and practices, to read that a consumer would not have standing because he didn't make a direct purchase would mean that that statutory section would be superfluous. And certainly the legislature did not intend to do that. With respect to interpreting the two statutes at issue, while I understand the court is well aware of the standards that have to be applied, I would like to emphasize that these are remedial statutes. They're statutes that are to be construed broadly to effectuate the purpose for which they were enacted. And 4043 was enacted to prevent abusive collection practices. And 480 was enacted to protect consumers and businesses. And in the context of that construction, I think there are three major points that the court needs to look to in making its ruling today. One, Rawlings was a collection agency under the terms of our statute. Two, plaintiffs are consumers under Chapter 480. And three, Rawlings' failure to register caused plaintiffs injury because plaintiffs paid money to them in response to an illegal demand. If the court looks at the definition of...
Did the plaintiffs owe the money to HMSA?
It was disputed. The letter that counsel cites that Mr. Lau wrote basically said, we dispute that this lien applies and we dispute that it's applicable. So it was a disputed debt.
But basis for the dispute was what?
Was that the lien statute doesn't apply to the particular circumstances of the expenses that were incurred by the plaintiffs in this case. I point out that while counsel for Rawlings refers to a settlement, there was no settlement. There was a release by Rawlings of plaintiffs' claims. There was no settlement agreement where plaintiffs basically said, look, we agree that this is a resolution of all claims. I'd also like to point out that fortunately for these plaintiffs, they did have a lawyer. While counsel points out to the fact that a lawyer was involved, many debtors do not have lawyers and do not have the benefit of being able to challenge the requirements that are imposed under the law. And particularly,
I'm sorry, I wanted to zero in on what you said was a purchase. Are you saying that when the consumer agrees to pay the excess of medical expenses, that is a purchase?
No, if I said that, I misspoke.
I misunderstood that. Can you explain that again?
Yes, there is an obligation that both of these plaintiffs had when they went to get doctor's treatment. They have to sign a document that says, I'm going to pay for this treatment. So what I was intending to say was that there are multiple levels that would allow these plaintiffs to be considered to be consumers and to fit within the statute. That's one level. The level of, I'm going to get a doctor's service and I'm agreeing to pay. And then I pointed out, Your Honor, that there are additional levels, which would be the loan agreement and then the specific requirements of 443B.
So you're reading consumer very broadly. The fact that they had a contract with a hospital that's really not involved in this transaction would still bring them under the consumer definition in 480.
Respectfully, Your Honor, is that that contract is at the heart of this transaction. While Rawlings continues to say, well, HMSA could have sued.
It's a HMSA contract with the employer, though, that it gives rise to the subrogation action.
That's correct, Your Honor. But it's the plaintiff's contract with the healthcare providers that gives rise to the transaction where the debt was collected. The debt was not collected under the for the insurance policy transaction, nor was it collected from the tort transaction. The only reason why a debt was collected was that plaintiffs received medical services, were obligated to pay for those medical services, and executed a loan agreement with HMSA saying we will pay you back.
What about the almost unanimous authority that says under 443 the subrogation situation doesn't fit the definition of a debt?
And again, respectfully, Your Honor, I'll disagree. I don't think that the authority is unanimous in any...
Near unanimous.
Again, I would respectfully disagree. First of all, you can look at different cases, the unpublished Texas case that was cited, and you can look at the federal statute or various state statutes and make a determination of whether subrogation rights are a debt. I would point the court in the first instance to our statute. And our statute contains exceptions to what is a collection agency, and also has a very specific definition of debt. And if the legislature had intended to draw an exception for subrogation rights or for lien rights, then they would have so specified, because they exempted banks, they exempted real estate agents, they exempted individuals who collect for their own business. So while there is authority that construes subrogation rights to be a debt, this contrary authority that construes subrogation rights not to be a debt, I would point the court and say, let's look at our statute and let's see what our statute says and whether the policies of our statute are being followed by carving out this exception.
Counsel for appellant has said there is no standing because there is no injury. So what's your response to that?
In looking at injury, obviously we now segue to Chapter 480. And I would point the court to the large body of law in this jurisdiction, maybe not starting with the I case, but succinctly stated in the I case, that a consumer is injured under 480 where he's wrongfully induced to pay money. A consumer is injured under 480 where they're paying money that's not supposed to be made. And in other cases, the court has looked and said, well, a claim under 480 is kind of like fraud. Or in the contractual section, it's a benefit of the bargain. And what we do is we put the plaintiff back in the position that that plaintiff would have been if the wrongdoing had not occurred. And so the damage directly is these plaintiffs paid money to a collection agent that was not licensed. They did not fulfill the absolute precondition for making a collection. This is not a dispute with HMSA. It's not a dispute about HMSA's subrogation rights or rights to reimbursement, although those were contested, as I pointed out. This is a dispute between plaintiffs and the Rawlings Company, where the Rawlings Company, acting as a collection agent, says, we demand that you pay monies to us. If the court will look at the Claims Recovery Services Agreement, which counsel alluded to, there's no question that Rawlings meets the definition of a collection agency. They were collecting money for another person. The money they were collecting was based on claims, and they were collecting it for a commission. And there's nothing in our statutory language that exempts a company like Rawling that respectfully may characterize itself as a subrogation reimbursement vendor. But it's not a subrogation reimbursement vendor. It's an agency that is collecting money on behalf of someone else. The injury that I alluded to earlier is a direct injury under our statute. It's a direct injury because it was made in response to payments, illegal payments demands by Rawlings. And I think if the court looks at The requirements under 443B for a entity to be a collection agent and looks to see that, or a collection agency, and looks to see that there are no exceptions for subrogation or reimbursement actions. There are no exceptions for whether it's a valid or an invalid obligation. There are no exceptions for whether it's an existing obligation or not an existing obligation. It's broadly drafted to include all types of transactions. And to carve out this large piece of a transaction, as Rawlings says, let's carve out subrogation and reimbursement rights because we characterize them as subrogation reimbursement rights. And let's carve out collections on valid debts because those aren't intended to be within the statute. Then the court is left with a small series of protections, and a small series of protections that simply aren't a detriment to consumers, but I would point out are a detriment to business as well, because the protections go both ways.
Mr. Grande, in IE, the court, attorney's fees aside, said that because the plaintiffs owed the money under some promissory note or something, that they weren't injured, and so that their obligation to pay that money was still existed. So in your situation, your clients supposedly, at least under the HMSA agreement, owes reimbursement. So isn't that situation similar to what occurred in IE?
It's not, and I apologize to the court for mispronouncing the name of
mispronounced it.
But if the court looks at that opinion, what IE was construing was section 443.44 subsection 8, which is currently 443B18.8. That is a section under fraudulent, deceptive, or misleading representations that talks about existing obligations. It is the section that IE was construing. And that section basically says a representation that an existing obligation may be increased by the addition of attorney's fees is not appropriate. And if the court remembers, in IE, the collection agency said we're going to collect 33%, but the statute says you're limited to 25%. So the discussion of existing obligations only had to do with the part of the promissory note that was declared invalid, which was the attorney's fees that were declared invalid. The promissory note itself was not declared invalid. I would also point out to the court.
Isn't that portion of the case similar to your situation, that you owe an obligation and therefore you haven't suffered an injury? That you have an obligation, therefore you haven't suffered an injury.
It's not, Your Honor. First of all, the collection agency in IE was registered. They were allowed to do business in the state of Hawaii. Secondly, the obligation itself was disputed. And third, if I could read into what the court's concerns, you know, are plaintiffs going to be get a windfall, or are they going to be unjustly enriched because they're now claiming from an unlicensed collector pay our money back? Well, there are three parties that are in this case. HMSA got their money. Rawlings got its money on its commission, and the only individuals who have suffered are the plaintiffs because they paid money in response to an illegal demand. I think if the court has to look at the underlying transaction and say, well, you owed the money anyway, no harm, no foul, I think that would totally eviscerate the statute. And Justice Acoba, I'm a...
Whether it would eviscerate the statute, are you conceding that the plaintiffs owed the money anyway?
No, respectfully, I'm not. That was a disputed issue. It's contained in Mr. Lau's email, which is attached to the motion for summary judgment, that it was a disputed issue. There was no acknowledgement that the money was owed. And when I alluded earlier...
When you say that HMSA got its money anyway, what money? Or got its money, what money?
The money that was collected from plaintiffs, from which Rawlings withdrew its portion, and then transmitted the remainder to HMSA.
Was HMSA legally entitled to that money?
Again, there was a dispute about that. I don't believe that they were legally entitled under the facts that Mr. Lau was was arguing. But let's suppose that they were, just for argument's sake. It was a legal entitlement. This is not a case where HMSA is going to the plaintiffs and saying, please pay us money that's legally owed. HMSA used an intermediary, a collection agency, a mainland collection agency not registered to do business here, which then acted as a collection agency on its behalf. We have a very different situation than an insurance company seeking to enforce its subrogation rights directly with the consumer or attempting to enforce its subrogation rights. We have a company using a collection agency that under our statute is supposed to register. And the fact that the legislature has said, we consider the violations of 443B to be so egregious that it's a per se violation of Chapter 480. There are only a handful of violations such as that, where the legislature says, we consider this to be so important that you have to prove nothing more than a violation of this statute in order to fall under the protections of Chapter 480. And I think, as I alluded to earlier in my argument, when the court looks at the confluence or the integration or the relationship between 443B and Chapter 480, it is a statutory scheme that basically allows a business or a consumer who's been injured by wrongful acts, and I would submit to the court respectfully that the wrongful act in this case is as egregious as any other abusive collection practice.
Did the plaintiffs seek injunctive relief in their complaint?
The plaintiffs did seek injunctive relief in their complaint. That is a component of the cause of action. It's also a class action case, although the summary judgment was decided before class certification. To conclude, Your Honors, I think that on the record presented before this court, Rawlings is a collection agency. There are no statutory exemptions for subrogation or reimbursement rights. There are no statutory exemptions for valid obligations versus invalid obligations. Plaintiffs were consumers because of the underlying transaction, the obligation to pay medical services, the loan agreement with HMSA, and plaintiffs were directly and severely injured by the fact that they paid money to an illegal entity. And I would just close, if I may, Your Honor, with a comment on...
Incidentally, what's your response to counsel's argument that loan agreement was an inartful characterization of the document, that it didn't generate any contractual obligations either way that or any other obligations that didn't pre-exist?
I quote from the loan agreement, if I may, Your Honor. Quote, by signing below, I request HMSA to pay my medical expenses as a loan and agree to the above loan terms. Close quote. I don't think that you can get any more artful than that in trying to characterize a loan agreement as a loan agreement where the consumer has to specifically acknowledge the loan terms and acknowledge repayment. If I may close with just a comment on the court's decision in Zanakis-Pico, where the court looked at Chapter 480 and said, a purchase is not a requirement, and we're going to look at incidental expenses as appropriate elements of damage under Chapter 480. And that's really what the court in Kelly did, and actually what the court in Sambor did as well. Both courts said, if you don't register, it's a violation of 443, it's a violation of 480. The difference is that in Kelly, the court said, we agree that your incidental expenses are damages, but in Sambor, the court said, we don't think you've established a causal connection, so we're not going to grant you summary judgment. And the reason that I mention these cases as I'm closing, Your Honor, is that it would be anomalous if individuals who have suffered those incidental damages would have standing under 480 to try to remedy violations of 443B, and yet these plaintiffs who paid substantial amounts to an illegal, unregistered collection agency would not be able to maintain the same claim.
Although Sanborn sort of disavowed Kelly.
Sanborn disavowed Kelly with respect to its comment that it was that the court, that Judge Mulway said it wasn't clear about the connection between the expenses and you know, and the activity.
You seem to put some emphasis on what she said was actual damages. What are actual damages?
Actual damages are, again, pointing to this court's body of case law, actual damages are monies that were expended, wrongfully induced to be paid, to look at the IE case, or what I will characterize as incidental expenses, actual out-of-pocket expenses that were paid in response to an illegal action. Again, I think that in Sambor, the court said, you haven't established as a matter of summary judgment. Sambor was a denial of summary judgment on behalf of the plaintiff. So they allowed the plaintiff to go ahead and make their proof. On the record before this court, I would respectfully ask that the court affirm the trial court. There are substantial policy reasons to affirm, but more important and more fundamental, if the court looks at the clear language of our statute, clearly the elements that are required to be pled have been met. And in the context of a summary judgment denial, which of course is the procedural context that's before this court should affirm the trial court's ruling. Thank you.
I think we have to, the plaintiffs emphasize that Chapter 443, anytime you're seeking monies due from anybody or anything, you're collecting a debt. I think you have to look at the express language of the statute, and a collection agency means someone who's collecting money due on accounts or other forms of indebtedness. That's what a collection agency definition is under 443B-1, and collection agency is also defined to include under collection agency subsection 3 in Hawaii Revised Statutes, any person who regularly collects money due on accounts or other forms of indebtedness. And that's consistent with the federal statute and all other state statutes. It's not a debt unless it's due, money due and owing. And definition of debt is an obligation. We have to focus in on that. It's the same in the federal court definition, and all the states almost have the same definition. It's an obligation of a consumer to pay money or other forms of payment arising out of a transaction in which that money or property, which are the subject of the transaction, is primarily for personal family household use. The money that is the subject of this transaction is from the tort claim. The transaction in this case is the tort claim. But for the tort claim, HMSA would have had no rights, and HMSA would have not pursued the third party tortfeasor claim. That is the transaction. And as appellee's counsel said, there were many transactions in this case. But the only transaction that is at issue here for this court is the tort. And that is the way the cases look at this. A subrogation claim, number one, it's not due and owing. At the time Rawlings contacted plaintiff's counsel, there was just the fact that plaintiffs were making that claim. They had asserted they're going to make a claim for the third party tortfeasor for that bundle of rights you get in a tort claim, including the medical benefits. You can't find, subrogation claims are not found to be debts because, number one, they're, in this case, it was not due and owing when the claims were made. Well, Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that because I wanted to focus back in too on the letters from plaintiff's counsel that we referred to. All he was disputing, and they're cited in our briefs in the record, they're in the record volume 3, the Flores letter is at page 318, and the Raposa letter or email is in volume 3. Oh, I'm sorry, volume 4, and they're both just with asterisks because it was filed under seal. All counsel for plaintiffs was disputing was whether it was general or special damages. It was the standard dispute, you all know, in these personal injury claims, that the plaintiff's counsel always says, my release is for general damages only. So none of the monies are for your reimbursement of your medical expenses. And that was the same argument made in Witherwax. And this court, with the state asserted its lien rights under the same statute, like 663-10. And this court said, no, you know, it's unfair for you to claim those monies as special damages, as we all know they do. They refer to special damages as an element of the claim. It's unfair for you to do that and just couch it as general damages and get, like, they're getting the double benefit. HMSA pays the monies, and they want to keep the monies HMSA paid for that exact purpose. And you look at I don't think the dispute was whether or not it was a debt or whether HMSA was entitled to that under the debt statute. They were just doing the general special damages thing, and that's why they compromise in the end, as they all do. They say, take some of my attorney's fees off, and they had to reimburse from the third-party tort claim. They actually got a windfall because HMSA did not take the entire amount from the third party that it was entitled to. Now, I want to get to the...
Why couldn't the transaction for purposes of the definition of debt in 443B1 be viewed as the loan agreement?
Because...
I mean, the language that Mr. Grandy quoted certainly sounded contractual to me.
But didn't create any new rights. And in this case, HMSA went under its equitable subordination rights. It went under the rights that it existed at the moment by operation of Hawaii law, that after, when the contract for insurance was signed, it didn't, no rights. When HMSA paid the medical expenses, no rights. When the plaintiffs made a claim against the third-party tortfeasors, the right arose under equitable subordination, and that is what was pursued by HMSA.
The characterization of monies paid to the insured on its behalf as a loan didn't recast the nature of the transaction at all?
I don't believe so. As I said, I don't like the title, but the right was already existing in HMSA by virtue of operation of law and equitable subordination. And what they did
until the plaintiffs signed the loan agreement, would any pre-existing contract establish that HMSA was lending it's insured any money?
Well, no, the plan just says that HMSA has the right to seek reimbursement of these amounts. But, Your Honor, HMSA never, Rawlings never sent plaintiff's counsel letters saying the amount of the debt is X. I mean, the amount we paid is X, and under the loan agreement, you owe us X. They never did that, and they don't do that. All we have is this case. They dealt with plaintiff's counsel under equitable subordination and the lien principles of 663-10. And if you look at Mr. Lau's letter and email relative to the settlement, he talks about the 663-10 lien, that you got to cut off apart for my attorney's fees, and that I'm not a lot, you know, I'm only, you're not entitled to special damages. So this is all you have, is this case, and Rawlings talking with lawyers. And I just want to point out that Stevens case I sent to the court, which was decided after final briefing, the Washington State case, I sent it by letter to the court. I mean, that is a case that shows subrogation of this type is not a debt. And in that case, what you had was a medical reimbursement organization sending letters out. They had a debt collector sending letters out saying, you know, at the time a claim is asserted by these injured parties, we paid $8,000 for your medical expenses. You owe that to us. It's due and owing now. If you don't pay us now, we're going to take you into litigation. And these consumers sued under a similar 480 statute for unfair and deceptive practices because it's not due and owing. And these consumers were scared. They were worried about their credit ratings because this subro reimbursement medical vendor group was saying, you know, it's a debt. and it's due and owing now. So I think from a public policy perspective, it's not right. The Hawaii law does not leave these plaintiffs without a remedy, and no contortion of cases like A'i, I guess if it's Hawaiian, and I if it's Chinese, but no contortion of the cases like they do changes the fact that subrogation is not a debt. Also, I just want to, I know my time's up, I apologize, but the Federal Trade Commission, which is responsible for interpretation of the Federal Debt Collection Practices Act, and the definition of debt in that act is the same as the Hawaii Act. If you go to FTC.gov, in 1992, they issued an opinion, and it's called the Dunn Letter under Advisory Letters for 1992, and they said that a subrogation claim of this type, a tort claim arising out of a tort, is not a debt under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And finally, just one last thing. This only came to my attention after the briefing was done, but Rawlings has been held by the United States District Court in an unpublished opinion for the District of Louisiana to not be a debt collector under the statute, the federal statute. So I just wanted to point that out, and if there's no more questions, I apologize for overrunning my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
We'll take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.